As the spring of 1779 crept into New York, Woodhull was near panic, obsessed with the fear that he was on the verge of being found out and arrested. There was one promising development, however, which gave Woodhull a sense of relief. The long-awaited arrival of a particular concoction that promised to give him an added layer of security. Washington had obtained a supply of invisible ink and issued Woodhull a vial of the precious substance for the writing of the Culper reports. The practice of writing with disappearing inks was nothing new. For centuries, people had been communicating surreptitiously through natural and chemically manipulated inks that became visible when exposed to heat, light, or acid. By the 18th century, it was common practice to expose, via these methods, letters suspected to contain secret information in an effort to reveal any hidden content written in white ink. Secret correspondence in the British military often had a subtle F or A in the corner, indicating to the recipient whether the paper should be exposed to fire or acid. But the usefulness of these devices was limited because they were all so well known. Washington wanted something innovative and unknown to the British, and he received such a solution from a statesman and spymaster of the Hudson Valley named John Jay. Jay's older brother had developed an ink that only became visible through the application of a specific sympathetic stain. Both the ink and the stain required a complicated recipe and special workshop, and they were extremely difficult to manufacture in any great quantity, so they were valuable commodities. When Washington received his first batch of the ink, he was delighted with the effect. It was, in a way, an unbreakable code, impervious to any of the usual means of discovery. Even if the British suspected a white ink message in any particular letter, they had no way of revealing it unless they, too, possessed the stain necessary to see the writing. That small vial of ink must have been a huge relief to Woodhull. He had been waiting for its arrival for months, ever since the ink's existence was first mentioned to him, aware of how sparing he must be with its use, and yet eager to entrust all of his gathered reports to its protection. He could hardly wait to begin writing back to Washington all that he was witnessing as New York began to thaw from another long winter. Chapter 20. Panic and a Traitor. Woodhull's enthusiasm was short-lived. While he was away in New York City collecting information, British soldiers surrounded his home, questioned his family, and beat his father when they couldn't find Abraham. A prisoner of the British had named Abraham Woodhull as a spy. Washington took pity on Woodhull and asked him to recruit a substitute. Chapter 21. The Peaceable Man, Robert Townsend. Robert Townsend was a quiet boy from a prominent Oyster Bay, Long Island family with a history of independent thinking, which he had inherited. A peaceable man, he did his best to stay out of the war, until one event forced him to take a stand. Townsend ran a modest dry goods shop in Lower Manhattan, now solidly in British hands. He prospered in the midst of the enemy by being unobtrusive and trying to stay out of political discussions. But all people have breaking points, moments when they have seen one atrocity too many, weathered one insult too many, stayed still for one day too long, and they know they must act or hate themselves for keeping silent. For Robert Townsend, that moment arrived in the fall of 1778. As Abraham Woodhull and his initial ring were beginning their intelligence war against the British in Manhattan and Long Island, the occupying armies were settling comfortably in various private residences, including the homestead, Robert Townsend's beloved home in Oyster Bay. Lieutenant Colonel John Simcoe, the man who had ordered the beating of Woodhull's father, decided that the Townsend family's house, one of the more comfortably situated and furnished dwellings in the town, fit his purposes quite nicely. He proceeded to set up his headquarters in the main part of the home, letting the family use just a few back rooms. At Simcoe's orders, British troops destroyed the orchard, of which Robert's father had been so proud, to feed British fires and help build a fort. The town operated as if under martial law, with roughly 470 enemy soldiers quartering there, including Hessian mercenary squads that roamed the streets to make sure residents stayed indoors at night. There were public lashings for those who displeased the soldiers, and little recourse for those who brought complaints. The town was quickly descending into a simmering chaos, and any lingering loyalist feelings among the good people of Oyster Bay were rapidly evaporating. When Robert returned home in November 1778 to visit his family, he was no doubt shocked by his father's defeated appearance and posture. There were too many soldiers around to dare publicly voice any dissatisfaction with the current state of things, but tales of hardship and abuse were recounted in hushed tones and with sideways glances to check for British ears. Robert burned with anger as he learned of the liberties taken with neighbors' properties and lives. He could only stare in mute fury as he observed how the soldiers, including Colonel Simcoe himself, flirted openly with his sisters under their father's roof. The Townsend family stood as much chance of evicting Simcoe from their property as they did of expelling the whole enemy encampment from Long Island. They were in British-held territory, so British laws stood and protesters fell, or were hanged. When Robert returned to his shop in Manhattan, he was haunted by what he had seen. It is possible that the notion of spying had already crossed Robert Townsend's mind before Abraham Woodhull entered his shop in the late spring of 1779. It may have already been clear to Townsend that his position in the city gave him access to potentially valuable information. After all, he was privy to scraps of conversation between soldiers in his own shop, could note the flow of supplies and men into and out of the harbor as he inspected his own shipments on the docks, and could observe the habits and patterns of the higher-ranking officers who graced James Rivington's posh new coffee house just down the street. But even if such an idea had introduced itself to his mind, it may not have been a welcome thought or one that he relished. And even if he had been eager to undertake such an effort, he would have had no channel for it, no clearly defined plan for how to get such information into the hands of those to whom it meant something, until he found himself across the table from the old acquaintance who now offered him a new mission and a new name. Samuel Culper, Jr. The two men talked long into the night, discussing every eventuality, every risk, and every pressing reason why these risks didn't ultimately matter. Woodhull would add Senior to his code name, and Townsend would become Culper, Jr. No one need ever know, nor even have the means to discover, the real man behind the intelligence reports. Woodhull's earlier desire for anonymity now paled in comparison to that of Townsend, who insisted that no one other than Woodhull and the courier, not even General Washington, should be aware of his involvement. Townsend was leery even of the courier knowing his face, but relented out of necessity. Woodhull wrote to Washington on June 20. My success hath exceeded my most sanguine expectations. I have communicated my business to an intimate friend. It was with great difficulty I gained his compliance, checked by fear. He is a person that hath the interest of our country at heart, and of good reputation, character, and family, as any of my acquaintance. I am under the most solemn obligations never to disclose his name to any but the post, who unavoidably must know it. I have reason to think his advantages for serving you and abilities are far superior to mine. Chapter 22. Washington's Orders. General Washington was delighted with the proposal, and together with Talmadge, drafted a detailed list of guidelines and directives for his new agent in New York. The full document below offers an intimate perspective on Washington's philosophies regarding spying and the specific mission of Culper Jr. Instructions: Culper Jr. to remain in the city to collect all the useful information he can. To do this, he should mix as much as possible among the officers and refugees, visit the coffee houses and all public places. He is to pay particular attention to the movements by land and water in and about the city, especially how their transports are secured against attempt to destroy them, whether by armed vessels upon the flanks or by chains, booms, or any contrivances to keep off fire rafts. The number of men destined for the defense of the city and environs, endeavoring to designate the particular corps and where each is posted. To be particular in describing the place where the works cross the island in the rear of the city, how many redoubts are upon the line from river to river, how many cannon in each, and of what weight and whether the redoubts are closed or open next to the city. Whether there are any works upon the island of New York between those near the city and the works at Fort Niffhausen or Washington, and if any, whereabouts and of what kind. To be very particular to find out whether any works are thrown up on Harlem River, near Harlem Town, and whether Horn's Hook is fortified. If so, how many men are kept at each place, and what number and what sized cannon are in those works. To inquire whether they have dug pits within and in front of the lines and works in general, 3 or 4 feet deep, in which sharp-pointed stakes are fixed. These are intended to receive and wound men who attempt a surprise at night. The state of the provisions, forage and fuel to be attended to, as also the health and spirits of the army, navy, and city. These are the principal matters to be observed within the island and about the city of New York. Many more may occur to a person of Culper Jr.'s penetration, which he will note and communicate. Culper Sr.'s station to be upon Long Island to receive and transmit the intelligence of Culper Jr. As it is imagined that the only post of consequence which the enemy will attempt to hold upon Long Island in case of attack will be at Brooklyn, I would recommend that some inhabitant in the neighborhood of that place, and seemingly in the interest of the enemy, should be procured, who might probably gain daily admission into the garrison by carrying on marketing, and from him intelligence might be gained every day or two of what was passing within, as the strength of the garrison, the number and size of the cannon, etc. Proper persons to be procured at convenient distances along the Sound from Brooklyn to Newton, whose business it shall be to observe and report what is passing upon the water, as whether any vessels or boats with troops are moving, their number, and which way they seem bound. There can be scarcely any need of recommending the greatest caution and secrecy in a business so critical and dangerous. The following seem to be the best general rules: to entrust none but the persons fixed upon to transact the business. To deliver the dispatches to none upon our side but those who shall be pitched upon for the purpose of receiving them, and to transmit them, and any intelligence that may be obtained, to no one but the commander-in-chief. Washington thought Brooklyn was the one place on Long Island that the British would regard as indispensable, because the Culper Ring's route of conveying messages passed directly from Manhattan to Brooklyn, before continuing on to Setauket and across the Sound to Connecticut. The courier would have an excellent opportunity to observe military activity in Brooklyn and could add any relevant information to the letter he was carrying from Townsend. In short, the route seemed as close to an ideal arrangement as Washington could hope for at the time. Chapter 23. The Cover Story, James Rivington. Robert Townsend's career as a spy began in that summer of 1779. His fears of the courier knowing his identity proved largely needless. Woodhull himself, at least at first, seems to have been the primary person who retrieved Townsend's reports to begin their circuitous route to General Washington. Townsend soon felt he needed a way to move more freely about the city, making inquiries and giving people a reason to trust him. In other words, he needed a cover story, and he found one just down the street, in the coffee house and print shop of an English expatriate named James Rivington. In 1773, Rivington had started publishing his own newspaper as a neutral press with the tagline "Open and Uninfluenced," but eventually the paper began to promote, as did so many newspapers of the era, a very specific and forceful worldview. In Rivington's case, it was loyalty to King George. Recognizing the possibility for a perfect cover story, Townsend applied for a job at Rivington's paper to write the occasional column of local interest. Rivington recognized the quiet shopkeeper from down the street and was happy to take him up on his offer to contribute to the Royal Gazette. It was a stroke of brilliance on Townsend's part. He now had the perfect excuse for asking questions, jotting down details, and questioning movements of troops and supplies into, out of, and around the city. What was more, Rivington's loyalist politics would help deflect any suspicion that Townsend might be harboring patriotic sentiments. Another, more sinister figure was establishing himself at Rivington's coffee house at the same time, however. The British had wasted no time in developing their own spy network. In the spring of 1779, General Henry Clinton, the new commander-in-chief of the British Army in America, had appointed the dashing young major John André as his chief intelligence officer. The major had impressed the general with his wit and savvy when the general arrived in Philadelphia in the early months of 1778. Now, a little over a year after they first became acquainted, Clinton entrusted André with the task of managing British espionage efforts in the colonies, with a specific eye on New York. André and Clinton were well aware that Washington was desperate to retake New York and had to be sending spies there. Eager to intercept Patriot agents, the new intelligence officer set up his headquarters in Manhattan. Chapter 24. The Mysterious Lady. In his letter to Talmadge, dated August 15, 1779, Woodhull recorded that there was a specific lady of my acquaintance so situated as to outwit them all. Her sudden appearance in his letters following the recruitment of Townsend, as well as the fact that Townsend's shop ledger shows he and Woodhull met that same day, hints that she may have been introduced to the ring by Townsend himself. That she was already of Woodhull's acquaintance indicates that her name, at least, was already known to him prior to that day, perhaps indicating that she or her family were originally from Long Island. But her apparent presence in Manhattan of late meant that she was somehow uniquely positioned to collect important secrets in a cunning and charming manner that would leave her marks completely unaware that they had just been outwitted by a secret agent. But who was this mysterious woman so perfectly poised to steal such vital secrets? Woodhull was careful not to record her name, offering only a number, 355, in the code that was to define the Culper Ring. The identity of Agent 355 remains a mystery to this day. Chapter 25. Hiding in Plain Sight. Several close calls involving captured letters had made the creation of a code essential for the Culper Ring. The spy ring had already begun to use a few numerical substitutions in their letters. For example, 10 stood for New York and 20 for Setauket, so that the recipient would know the source of the information contained in the reports. Two additional numbers, 30 and 40, were used to designate Jonas Hawkins and Austin Rowe as post riders delivering the messages to their next destination. Talmadge now realized how essential it was to develop a more complete code dictionary and to assign every member or associate of the ring a number rather than just a code name. In a style of cryptography developed originally by the French, Talmage selected a book and got to work. He chose Entick's New Spelling Dictionary, the 1777 London edition. First, using the dictionary, he made a list of all the words he thought the ring would need to use to communicate. Then he added people's names, local places, and other words. Finally, his list was 763 words long. He assigned each word, location, or name a number from 1 to 763. He became 721. Woodhull as Culper Sr., 722. Townsend as Culper Jr., 723. Rowe, 724. And Brewster, 725. General Washington was 711, and his British counterpart, General Clinton, was 712. Numbers were represented by letters so that the year 1779, for example, would read as ENNQ. If a word needed to be made plural or put in the past or future tense, a flourish would be written on top of it to designate the change. The new system was not foolproof and required some adjustments on the part of the users, but Woodhull and Talmage were able to use it to correspond comfortably within a few weeks. The Patriot spies and their superiors investigated many ways of sending messages. Washington advocated hiding messages in plain view. If a letter was treated with the utmost caution and concern, it was more likely to appear suspicious and tip off British inspectors. If, instead, the spies passed along highly sensitive information hidden in a book or disguised as dull letters on day-to-day family news, the vehicle by which the message was being sent would probably not warrant a second glance, he thought. With Rivington's print shop operating just down the street, and as someone who enjoyed an established relationship with the owner, Townsend had no shortage of books available for sending messages the way Washington suggested. But Townsend, using his invisible ink, seems to have preferred an alternative means of his own design. When the courier, usually Woodhull or Rowe, judging from his store's ledger, arrived to pick up the goods he had purchased to bring back to Long Island, among them would be a packet of blank writing paper. Concealed within those loose sheets of paper was a seemingly blank one that contained the invisible letter, to be rendered readable once it reached its destination and the stain was applied. All in all, this method worked extremely well as an innocuous way to smuggle reports out of the city. With these new security measures in place, and Culper Jr. and Agent 355 firmly established in their roles in New York, the ring could now begin to forward intelligence more swiftly, more safely, and in greater detail than before, though the risk of detection and capture remained. The life of a spy always requires looking over one's shoulder, but now Washington's operatives could enjoy at least a little more freedom to speak about their observances, with less need to censor their words in case a letter fell into the wrong hands. The added security was just in time, too. Suspicions and tensions were beginning to rise as the summer of 1779 reached its peak, and all the agents were feeling the stress. Indeed, letters were now being searched by the British with regularity as they left the city. Jonas Hawkins twice believed he was in danger of being found out and destroyed the messages he was carrying from Townsend. In addition to British searches, the couriers also faced dangers from increasingly active privateers working for the British. These privateers were authorized to board and search any boat they felt was suspicious. In his letter dated November 1, 1779, Talmage wrote to General Washington of the growing hazards faced by the once fearless Caleb Brewster. The boat that crosses for dispatches from Culper has been chased quite across the Sound by those plunderers. Perhaps for the sake of being the more secret in their villainy, while our crew has suspected them to be the enemy. Indeed, if some stop cannot be put to such nefarious practices, Culper will not risk, nor 725 Brewster, go over for dispatches. Chapter 26. Thwarting a Plot. Meanwhile, there was a covert storm brewing in New York, one that Townsend was in the process of uncovering and confirming, that threatened the Americans not through bloodshed or siege, but through their pocketbooks. Although the colonists used British currency for buying and selling, they also used paper money printed by the colonial governments. These bills were not backed by gold or silver, and so were not worth much. To make them worthwhile, both the buyer and the seller had to believe the money exchange was fair. The British, recognizing how fragile the American currency was, decided to weaken it further by running counterfeiting operations aboard British ships and even on shore where possible. They printed fake colonial money and used it to pay merchants. The operation introduced thousands of fake bills into the economy, so every bill was now worth even less than before. The Continental Congress had made some efforts to combat the counterfeiting, but had limited success. Eventually, they developed a special paper of a very precise quality and thickness that would be used to produce the bulk of the money minted in Philadelphia for the colonies, a paper they hoped would be extremely difficult to replicate. This would allow the government much greater control over the amount of bills in circulation. Townsend learned of a British plot to steal the paper. On November 27, 1779, he wrote with urgency to Washington that several reams of the paper made for the last emissions struck by Congress have been procured from Philadelphia. The safeguard that the Americans were counting on to protect their currency had been breached. Somehow, whether through negligence or a double agent, the paper and possibly even the printer plates had made their way to New York, where the British would use them to churn out perfect counterfeits. Distribution of the fakes in New York would drive down prices and sink the economy of the colonies right in the heart of their main trading hub. The magnitude of this plot, and the fact that the worthless bills would be undetectable before it was too late, made this intelligence of utmost importance. With word from the culpers delivered swiftly, Washington was able to alert Congress to the scheme. The resulting action, a cancellation of all colonial bills a few months later, in March 1780, was drastic and potentially devastating in itself, but far less destructive to the American economy and morale than a sneak attack on its currency would have been. Just how had Townsend uncovered such a plan? He may have happened upon some gossip by lucky coincidence, but the certainty with which Townsend outlined the plan for Talmadge and Washington indicates that he had a much more intimate knowledge of the scheme than just hearsay. His likely source? The newest member of the ring, newspaper editor and former loyalist, James Rivington. Sometime in 1779, Rivington secretly threw in his lot with the Americans and began to work alongside Robert Townsend, gathering information. Rivington proved a valuable asset to Townsend's work. Taking advantage of his profession, he provided books for the spy's use. Sometimes the book bindings hid slips of paper holding intelligence that Rivington himself had gleaned from the loyalist guests and friends who patronized his coffee house. The British were being played, and from the least likely of corners, but they remained oblivious to the double dealings in their midst. In the coffee house, British officers, surrounded by their admirers, discussed their plans. They were relaxed and confident, and they were being carefully watched and listened to all the while. Now Washington had tasted victory. His agents had outsmarted the enemy in their own territory. It could be done. By revealing the counterfeiting plot, the culper ring had proved that New York was not some insurmountable fortress. They had penetrated its vault of secrets successfully, and unmasked an entire plot before it could be played out to its catastrophic end. Best of all, the enemy had no way of knowing at what stage the plan might have been leaked, and no way of tracing back any breaches of secrecy. Washington's informants, therefore, were relatively safe from detection and could continue their activities without too much concern for their welfare. Chapter 27. The Need for a New Route. Washington was certain there were many more plots afoot. Now that one plan had been foiled, another would soon be hatched, probably with more speed this time, to minimize the risk of leaks. But the smuggled messages were not meeting the pressing demands Washington was facing. Events were accelerating rapidly, and the laborious means of conveying the letters out of occupied New York and Long Island into Connecticut and overland to Washington's camp was too slow. Instead of offering new information, the Culper Ring's intelligence was now providing verification of facts the general had already learned. He pored over the maps as he would before a battle. Perhaps there was a way to convey messages across the Hudson River or via Staten Island. He wrote as much to Talmadge, urging him to talk to Culper Sr. about such an option, hoping to impress upon the ring the importance of timely reports. Washington felt a growing sense of urgency about seeing the cracks in New York's armor pursued even more aggressively. If the British were plotting any offensive maneuvers from the city, he wanted to be prepared. Townsend looked for new couriers who could carry messages northward across the Hudson, as the general had requested, instead of across the Sound and through Connecticut. Rather than choose an outsider, he turned to a family member, a cousin named James Townsend, who was only 16 or 17 years old at the time. The young man had no idea as to the exact nature of the letters with which he was entrusted. He only knew that they contained sensitive information that was important to his grave, somber cousin, and that the letters would land him in prison if his mission was found out. James set off under the assumed identity of a loyalist visiting relatives outside the city. His travels progressed smoothly until he stopped at the home of the Dusenberry family, who were secretly patriots in an otherwise loyalist-dominated area. James seems to have played his part so convincingly that the Dusenberry daughters, young women about his own age, believed his cover story and suspected that he might even be a loyalist spy. In the hope of causing him to spill his story, they pretended to be loyalists too. The boy set about to convince the family he was harmless, telling completely false tales of how he had helped the British. As the daughters complimented him, he told even taller tales. Finally, the girl's elder brother, John Dusenberry, leaped from a hiding place and declared that James was a prisoner. A terrified James was immediately carted off to the American Army camp nearby, where he was searched thoroughly, and John Dusenberry gave a detailed deposition on the matter. To the great disappointment of both the Dusenberries and the soldiers, nothing of interest was found on James, though they did commandeer the two sheets of paper he was carrying, which contained a groan-worthy poem called The Lady's Dress, on a page folded in a peculiar manner, signed with a nearly illegible ST. The soldiers sent the letters on to headquarters, and James was held in Patriot custody. Poor James's mission was not a complete debacle, because the papers did reach Washington. He recognized the unusual manner of folding, his own suggestion from a letter of September 24, 1779, and knew the initials ST indicated that stain was to be applied. The handwriting, too, was a giveaway that the papers had come from none other than Culper Jr. Washington was furious that so much unnecessary attention had been drawn to covert operations, wasting resources, and he had to intervene personally to get James released, since his captors continued to believe he was a British spy. Talmadge was briefed on the situation, and he, in turn, made sure that Woodhull understood the depth of Washington's displeasure. Part 3. Chapter 28. The French Arrive. In June 1780, a fleet of French ships was crossing the Atlantic, coming to give the Americans a much-needed boost of men, might, and morale. If the British intercepted them, it would be devastating for the Patriot cause. Washington had received intelligence that the fleet would be arriving soon at Newport, Rhode Island, but he could not be sure whether the British knew the same thing or had only rumors and suspicions from which to operate. If the British were ignorant of the specifics, the Americans might have the element of surprise on their side. If the British had advanced knowledge, they could move troops to engage the French as soon as they disembarked or even prevent their landing in the first place. It had taken a long time to win over the French, and the Americans could not afford to squander their new allies' good favor. On July 10, the French fleet dropped anchor at Narragansett Bay, Rhode Island. Washington sent an urgent letter to Talmadge. Talmadge received the letter on July 14 and immediately replied to the general that he would set out the next morning to find Brewster. Once located, Brewster eagerly set off to find Woodhull, who, unfortunately, was ill with a fever and could not travel. Instead, Austin Roe leaped upon a horse and headed straight for New York to alert Townsend, an exhausting 55-mile trip one way. Washington knew by now that General Clinton would be aware of the landing, too. Townsend's mission was to spy out the British response to the fleet's arrival. Roe waited in Manhattan 4 days while Townsend, and very likely Agent 355, made inquiries and gathered as much information as possible from their acquaintances among the British officers. There was indeed movement of British troops and ships. They were preparing for something. Townsend recorded the findings in invisible ink between the lines of an order form for goods from his store and included a fake note, apologizing that the merchandise was not available at the time, but would be forwarded when it arrived. Roe carried the note back with him, a simple cover story as to why he was carrying papers but no merchandise in case he should be searched, and gave the sensitive letter to Woodhull. Woodhull passed it on to Brewster that same night to row across the Sound, adding pressing directions. The enclosed requires your immediate departure this day. By all means, let not an hour pass, for this day must not be lost. You have news of the greatest consequence, perhaps, that ever happened to your country. Brewster rushed the letter straight to Washington's headquarters. Alexander Hamilton, Washington's closest aide, received the report on the afternoon of July 21. Chapter 29. Washington's gamble. Washington carefully considered the possibilities. He desperately wanted to capture New York City, and with Clinton leading most of the British troops stationed there northward toward Newport, Rhode Island, to engage the French, this could be his best opportunity. But Washington also knew better than to act rashly. He called together several of his top officers, and they discussed the likelihood of a successful attack on New York. The prevailing sentiment was that it would be unwise. Even with Clinton and a large number of his men gone, the city was still well fortified, and the battle would most likely end as a siege lasting many days, giving Clinton time to return with his soldiers and engage the Americans. Regretfully, Washington yielded to his counselors and agreed to reject his ambitions to recapture the city, but the brilliant strategist realized he could still capitalize on Manhattan's vulnerability. Satisfied with the decision not to attack New York, Washington dismissed his officers and then hurriedly began drawing up plans and penning correspondence, signaling that a full-fledged attack upon Manhattan would occur as soon as Clinton's forces were clear of the city and too near to Newport to be easily recalled. The parcel was dispatched with a courier who hastily left camp with very specific instructions on where and when to deliver the documents. Then Washington waited. A few hours later, the man stumbled up to a British outpost with the bundle of papers. He told the soldiers he had found it lying by the side of the road, assuming it had tumbled out of the poorly secured saddlebags of a rider traveling at breakneck speed. How it got there wasn't important, the British immediately concluded. A quick glance revealed battle plans for a pending attack on New York and letters outlining the strategy, all coming from the hand of Washington himself. The soldiers roused their senior officers, who quickly decided that Clinton and his troops must be recalled. Defeating the newly arrived French troops was important, but holding New York was doubly so. The British ships did an about-face to sail back to New York Harbor, where Clinton ordered his troops to brace the city for an attack that could come at any time. The whole city held its breath, every citizen straining to hear the first sound of cannon fire breaking the silence as the Americans advanced. They waited. And while they waited, the French disembarked and moved to an area of safety to await their marching orders. With no naval attacks upon their ships and no ground offensive from Clinton's army. Washington's gamble, made possible by the Culper Ring information, had paid off beautifully. The victory was bittersweet, though, because his first choice would have been to recapture New York. But he had been able to secure the safe arrival of the French reinforcements by planting information about a fake attack. The quality of the Culper Ring's information and the care they exercised in delivering it had enabled him to both understand the plans of the British and arrive at the decision not to risk an attack on New York. The ring had more than proved its worth, but the war was not yet won. Chapter 30. The Most Powerful Man on the Hudson River, Benedict Arnold. Now that the city of New York seemed to be secure, General Clinton became interested in expanding his grasp on New York beyond the boundaries of Long Island and Manhattan, and was eyeing the Hudson Valley as a means of controlling the land along the Hudson River, as well as the harbor at its mouth. At the same time, an American general named Benedict Arnold heard that the command at Fort West Point was available and decided it seemed the perfect solution to his various woes. Arnold had been living the high life in Philadelphia, but recent unpleasantness had wounded his ego, and he had found himself in an all-too-familiar position, humiliated, angry, and desperate to prove his worth. He was about to show the world just how important he really was. If the Americans couldn't see his value, the British would. Arnold had been involved in a number of key American victories and had distinguished himself as an insightful strategist and able officer. But his talents were not nearly so celebrated as Arnold believed was his due. He had also been involved in somewhat shady business, an audit of the records of the 1775 invasion of Quebec that he helped lead showed a substantial sum tied to Arnold for which there was no accounting or receipts. According to practice, the amount due was his own responsibility. He now owed the Continental Army more than £1,000. Arnold and his wife, the daughter of loyalists, mingled with the British troops at parties in her parents' home. Arnold met Major André there and began to hatch a plan to trade his loyalty for cash. While he may not have relished the thought of moving from cosmopolitan Philadelphia to remote West Point, the idea of being an absolute authority in his own fort must have appealed to his pride. He could quit the city, assume control of the strategic fort, and at precisely the right time, turn it over to the British. He would then collect his reward, pay off his debts, and enjoy a life of leisure as a man who had made the king's victory over the rebellion possible. In New York, General Clinton, too, recognized the potential of Fort West Point. It was situated 55 miles north of Manhattan, on a sharp turn of the Hudson River. From there, it was possible to control the access of ships to the rest of the river, thereby limiting or opening the movement of troops, supplies, and goods for trade. It was, in many ways, the key to the rest of the state. Through Major André, he urged Arnold to press his case for the command of the fort. At the end of July, with the French troops safely disembarked in Rhode Island, Washington prepared to ride out to meet them and proposed that Arnold lead a raid against some of Clinton's troops stationed around New York at the same time. Arnold pleaded to be excused from such exertion, saying that an injury had left him with a stiff ankle and his doctors had recommended that he not take command of an army until it healed. Conceding to Arnold's requests and complaints, Washington kept him off the battlefield and diverted him instead to the less physically demanding post as commander of West Point, exactly as Arnold had hoped. On August 3, 1780, Benedict Arnold found himself the most powerful man on the Hudson. He wasted no time in making the most of his new position. He began repairing the fort and stocking it with as many provisions as possible. If he was going to turn West Point over to the British, he might as well win points with his new commanders by outfitting it at the Americans' expense. Even more urgently, Arnold began to inquire about the names and addresses of Patriot spies he claimed might be of importance to him in defending the fort against any planned attacks by the British. Of particular interest to Arnold was the ring operating in New York, upon whom Washington had relied so heavily, both in the recent incident with the French fleet and in previous matters of significant intelligence, such as troop movements on Long Island and the foiled counterfeiting plan. The commander-in-chief declined the request out of both honor and necessity. He purposely did not know the identity of most of his spies, and he had sworn to uphold the secrecy of those he did know. By September, Arnold needed only a few details taken care of to bring his whole plan to fruition. First, he needed an opportunity to familiarize the British with the plans of the fort so that they could exploit its vulnerabilities and storm it as swiftly as possible. Second, he needed time to get the necessary British men and weapons hidden in place to ensure that any resistance the Patriots offered would be futile. He sent a letter to an American outpost, informing them that a certain merchant from the city by the name of John Anderson might be passing their way and begging their assistance in securing him safe passage to West Point. Then, Arnold tried to arrange a meeting with André outside the city to finalize their negotiations and plans for handing over the fort. When the long-anticipated meeting finally took place, André was to pose as the prosperous businessman. Chapter 31. What Robert Townsend Saw. Townsend, meanwhile, found that when he left his shop to observe the goings-on around Manhattan that September, he could not help but notice the uptick in preparations along the docks. The British were clearly fitting ships for some kind of engagement. Though Townsend could not be sure if this was merely a response to the arrival of the French fleet and the fear that a naval battle might be brewing, or if it was with some other specific aim. Even the soldiers and sailors with whom he conversed were uncertain as to their orders. It seemed unlikely that significant troop movements would be following so closely on the heels of the misinformation regarding Washington's supposed plans to attack the city, and the unanticipated recall of troops. Then again, the blow to Clinton's pride that incident had delivered might have prompted him to plan an aggressive response, simply to prove he would not be made the fool. None of the spies knew, however, quite what they were in the midst of in September 1780. The reports from the city, the strange behaviors, and the activity with the ships. Talmadge couldn't quite put his finger on it, but his instincts told him something was not right. He felt as if he had nearly all the elements in front of him, almost all the clues gathered, but he was not sure what he was looking at, nor what the picture was that he needed to assemble. That he had letters on his desk from his merchant spy in New York regarding an officer from the city venturing toward West Point seemed wholly unconnected. Despite all the hints he received from Agent 355 Woodall and Townsend, Talmadge didn't connect the dots until it was almost too late. Chapter 32. Benjamin Talmadge Figures It Out. Two meetings were set up between Arnold and André in his disguise as John Anderson. Neither worked out. Eventually, André boarded a British ship moored near West Point. He was rowed ashore, and he finally met Arnold to discuss the handover. During the meeting, the ship set sail for the south, so André slash Anderson had to travel back through Patriot-held territory to British-held Manhattan by horse. On September 23, André was stopped along the road by three eagle-eyed Patriot militiamen. André produced a letter of safe passage, signed by General Arnold, but that didn't satisfy the scouts. They searched his person and found that he had papers hidden in his socks. The papers, including letters between Anderson and Arnold, and what looked like plans of a fort, were sent to General Washington, but the prisoner was released on orders of Colonel Jameson, who was in charge of the area, and escorted back to Arnold at West Point. At Washington's headquarters, Talmadge heard talk of the newly apprehended prisoner named John Anderson. Something seemed strange about the story, but so much had of late that it was hard to pinpoint what was so unsettling. As Talmadge sat reviewing the letters at his desk, he happened to spot a note from General Arnold, sent some days previously, informing him of a certain man named John Anderson who might pass Talmadge's way. "I have to request that you will give him an escort of 2 horse to bring him on his way to this place, and send an express to me that I may meet him." Suddenly, it all made sense. The prisoner, the strange reports he was receiving from the culpers in New York, and Arnold's odd request. Hearing a full account of the story from the colonel who had released André, Talmadge put the bits of information together and concluded that a major betrayal was at hand. Talmadge persuaded Jameson to rescind his order and bring André back to the army camp just north of White Plains, New York, while they awaited word from Washington. Oddly enough, Jameson still insisted on informing Arnold of the turn of events. "Strange as it may seem," Talmadge wrote, "Lieutenant Colonel Jay would persist in his purpose of sending his letter to General Arnold. The letter did go on, and was the first information that arch-traitor received that his plot was blown up. The officer returned to Jameson's camp, with his prisoner early the next morning. Jameson's decision to alert Arnold to the matter, while shocking in retrospect, was quite understandable at the time, given Arnold's reputation. For one thing, Arnold was widely trusted by many officers of the Continental Army. He was also widely feared, and Jameson was willing to take extreme steps to protect himself from the man's wrath for not following his directives. Had Talmadge not been as acutely attuned to subtle clues and not been actively trying to piece together the culprit ring's reports, he too might have fallen under Arnold's spell and failed to realize who John Anderson really was. Even now, Talmadge kept the spies in mind and realized that more than just the fate of Fort West Point was at stake. The surrender of the fort had to be stopped at all costs, but in a somewhat delicate way. André would not have broadcast his travel plans beyond a select circle, and the collapse of his plan could endanger the spies who had helped unravel the plot. If word reached the British that there was a mole in André's inner circle, Agent 355 and any of her known associates, like Townsend, could be quickly unmasked. The entire ring would collapse, and the gallows would become a little more crowded. Talmadge would have to act swiftly, but carefully. Chapter 33. The Turncoat Escapes. General Washington and Alexander Hamilton were riding toward Fort West Point on the evening of Sunday, September 24. They had been visiting Hartford, Connecticut. Washington anticipated that Arnold would be happy to see him, just as he was eager to see what improvements Arnold had put into effect at the fort, now that he had been in command nearly 2 months. Arnold knew that Washington was on his way. Just after the first of Washington's entourage arrived, So did the letter from Colonel Jameson explaining that a gentleman by the name of Anderson, carrying passes issued by Arnold, had been captured and was in confinement while some odd papers and plans found on him were sent to General Washington via an express rider. It was all a wicked plan by the British, Jameson concluded, to besmirch Benedict Arnold's good name and to cause division in the ranks by undermining the Continental Army's confidence in him. He felt Arnold should be made aware of the slanderous efforts being made against him by the enemy. The jig was up. Arnold's worst fears had all been realized. The Americans were aware, or soon would be, of the depth of his treachery. But the British had yet to do anything to capture the fort and, without the plans, likely never would be able to do so. Thus, he was a traitor to one group, and hardly the hero he had anticipated becoming to the other. Now, he would be nothing more than a failed turncoat, if he were even able to escape with his life, that is. Arnold dashed off toward the water, telling his staff that he would return promptly, just as soon as he sorted out some urgent matter across the river. He called for his bargemen to row him as swiftly as possible downstream, toward where HMS Vulture had recently retreated, explaining to the confused men at the oars that they would receive 2 gallons of rum apiece if they did their job quickly, as he would need to turn around very shortly to meet General Washington for his much-anticipated visit. They exerted themselves admirably. The barge reached the Vulture under a flag of truce, which kept them from being fired upon and allowed Arnold to board in safety. His loyal crew were also taken aboard, where Arnold promptly informed them that they were now prisoners of the British Army. Safely tucked away on a ship in New York, Benedict Arnold was now enjoying the luxuries of high living, including the knowledge that his wife and infant son were safe from retribution. He wrote to Washington, asking if the general would guarantee their secure passage to him, and Washington agreed, not believing it proper to punish a child for the sins of his father. With Arnold's true loyalties now exposed, and his body, mind, and energies openly aligned with the British, he could pose no further threat to American forts or forces under his command. But Arnold was not finished sowing chaos for the Culper Ring. As Talmadge had feared, his capture spelled danger for the Secret Six. Chapter 34. The Prisoner is Executed. Arnold's backhanded, cowardly character contrasted sharply with that of his co-conspirator, André, who comported himself with dignity by all accounts and treated his captors with respect and even friendliness. But this was wartime, and there must be winners and losers. André had been caught and captured at the same game that Talmadge was playing. They both knew the rules, the rewards, the risks, and they both knew the penalties. In the 10 days that followed, a prisoner exchange was proposed, as was often the case when high-ranking officers were captured. General Washington was agreeable only if the prisoner surrendered was Arnold. General Clinton would not agree to these terms, so Washington proceeded as he would with any common spy. Washington granted André a trial, in which several of the top officers among the Continental Army and her allies were speedily assembled to hear arguments. André maintained that because he had been trapped and captured behind enemy lines, he was technically not a spy scouting the territory in the uniform of his service, but was, instead, a prisoner of war. All such prisoners, he reasoned, can be expected to at least consider making an escape dressed in civilian clothes. The plea failed to persuade the tribunal. André was sentenced to death by hanging on September 29. The sentence was to be carried out on October 2, just over a week after André's capture. He carried himself with dignity and propriety, stoically recognizing his sad fate as simply one of the unfortunate dangers of war. Chapter 35. The Ring in Peril. Even though Arnold was exposed, the plot to surrender for